This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Ahmed Rashid, who is an independent journalist based in Lahore, Pakistan. His articles appear all over the world in major newspapers and journals, including the New York Review of Book, BBC Online, The Telegraph in London, and the International Herald Tribune. He's the author of several books, and for more than two decades, these books have provided unmatched insight into terrorism and the geopolitics of the region of Central Asia. The books include The Resurgence of Central Asia, Taliban, Jihad, and his newest book is Descent into Chaos. Ahmed, welcome back to our program.
Great pleasure to be here after 6 years.
We really should talk about Pakistan. Is Pakistan a rogue state?
Well, no, I wouldn't describe it as that because I think there's the problem in Pakistan has been this perennial conflict between military power and civilian power. You've had bouts of civilian rule, but essentially the military have ruled the country, especially for the last 30, 40 years. And they have controlled foreign policy, particularly foreign policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan, Afghanistan and India. And it's been very, very difficult for these intermittent civilian governments. We had four in the 1990s. We've just got one now after the elections in February 2008. It's been very difficult for these civilian governments to encroach upon the military's control of foreign policy.
Let's help our audience know some of the facts about Pakistan. How many people? How large a country? It's the fifth largest country in the world, is that right?
It's 160 million people with a very high population growth rate, dwindling resources, huge problems now of energy, of water, of land. We are going to be, over 200 million very soon, and certainly a major economic crisis is probably pending.
Pakistan never sort of carved a national identity that all groups and ethnic groups could agree to, or is that a fair assessment?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think, Pakistan was born out of British India, a separate country in the name of Islam. But the founding fathers of Pakistan never imagined that it would be a theocratic state or a state run by religious leaders. Instead, they wanted a Western-style, British-style democracy. The constitution we have is parliamentary democracy, very much modeled on what Britain has. But the whole problem has been that after three wars with India, the national security issue with India, the dispute over Kashmir, the desire to have a pro-Pakistan government in Afghanistan, all these issues have really been driven by the military, and they have controlled these policy issues. As a result, at one point we were spending like 30% of the budget on the army. Mm-hmm. Education literacy is about 50%, one of the lowest in South Asia. We're not spending enough money on developing human capital and the social sector. And this has been one of the very, very big problems.
Mm-hmm. You say at one point, and you actually have already touched on this, but I want to unpack this. You say that in the history of Pakistan, there have been two important relations that are terribly important, the military to civil society and the state to Islam. So first, let's talk about the military to civil society, because the as you just described, its dominance over the system has led to a situation where civil society is really pushed down, repressed, and not able to realize the vitality that potentially is there.
Yes, I mean, we've seen that in these intermittent civilian governments. The military has not allowed these civilian governments to encroach upon what it considers its territory. Secondly, the military defines national interest. The civilians don't. So the military defines a national interest in terms of the enemy, India, bolstering military capability, which this is the reason Pakistan went nuclear. The civilians, if you ask them, they would define national interest completely differently. Democracy, a vibrant economy, education, mass literacy. These kind of categories don't come into the sort of military's thinking processes, unfortunately. The other thing is that the military has not just grown politically powerful, but it has grown economically powerful, especially under General Musharraf. He has given incredible perks and privileges to the military. A lot of the land in the country is owned by the military, or if it's not owned, it's seized upon by the military and developed according to what the military wants. The senior officers get far more perks and privileges than anybody in the civil sector. Almost all their children are studying in America on scholarships. They are a highly, highly, the most privileged group in the country.
Mm-hmm. At one point, you quote the famous expression that somebody coined about all countries have an army, but in Pakistan, the army has a country.
Well, yes, I mean, that's what many Pakistanis think, because, you know, I mean, everything is dictated by the army, no civilian leader can afford to rub the army the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. And you, the second relationship that you said was very important was the relationship of the state to Islam. And you've made the point in the book throughout that the military doesn't have a vested interest in building up the institutions of civil society, but they have used Islam to as an instrument. Talk about that.
Well, civil society, the political parties, view the founding fathers as being modernist, democratic, and they want to set up a democratic system where all the, for example, the non-Muslim minorities have the same rights, religion is part of the culture and tradition of the country, but it does not dictate the political process. Now, the problem with the military is that in order to further their foreign policy aims in Kashmir, towards India, and towards Afghanistan, they have fueled Islamic extremist groups, because these Islamic extremists, since the 1980s, especially when the Americans came and trained the Afghan Mujahideen to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, since then, the military has used these militants to fight in Kashmir, to fight in Afghanistan for their favored proxy force. And that, of course, has created a blowback in the country. I mean, you can't create militant groups and then expect them to just stay outside the country and fight foreigners. They will want to do the same thing internally. They will want to set up an Islamic State at home. And this blowback is what we have really suffered from very badly. We suffered from it at the end of the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s when the Soviets left the country. We suffered from it again during the Taliban period in the 1990s when we were supporting the Taliban, and the Taliban were getting recruits from Pakistan and thousands of Pakistanis were going off to fight for them. We suffered again with this blowback from Kashmir. And now, of course, after 9/11, there's been a much more severe blowback, because for the first time we have developed what we call now the Pakistani Taliban. And these are fighters who militant groups. They are mostly from the Pashtun ethnic belt in the northwest part of the country, but they're linked to other groups, the Kashmiri groups, the Punjabi extremist groups, and they all want to create, they want to carve out a Sharia state, that is a state for Islamic extremism in the northwest part of the country. And so now they have become a real threat.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, the chickens have come home to roost. And if you take the trajectory of all of your books, the situation over time gets worse and worse. So that in the beginning, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, there were no suicide bombers. But now you're seeing them.
Well, I mean, we have never had suicide bombing until very recently, when some, in the late 90s, some of the Kashmiri groups started suicide bombing at the behest of the military, having been trained by the military to do that. Now, of course, last year we had something like, in 2007, we had something like 70 suicide bombings. Now it's become kind of de rigueur, you know, and this is a tactic that has been bought in by Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda have been settled on the Pakistani border regions for the last 6-7 years. It's been bought in by the Afghan Taliban, who've adopted the same strategy while fighting in Afghanistan against American forces. So you've described it perfectly. I mean, the blowback after the Soviet war in the 80s was containable. There was the whole of society was armed with Kalashnikovs, and drugs came in for the first time, but it was still containable in a sense. And the end of the Soviet Union left a kind of vacuum in which these extremist groups didn't quite know which way to go. But the Taliban then has the blowback from the Taliban movement in the 90s has been very severe. But of course, the blowback from the post 9/11 period has been deeply affecting the whole fabric of society, because we gave refuge to the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban. We allowed them sanctuary in Pakistan. We allowed them to recruit and rearm in Pakistan. And I was writing, I was warning in 2002, 2003, that if we continue this, we are going to Talibanize Pakistan. There's no way you can keep these guys separate or put them out in the mountains and expect them to go and attack the Americans in Afghanistan without them influencing Pakistanis. And that's precisely what's happened.
Mm-hmm. There are 2 points here that I want to emphasize. And one is, explain to us what these federal territories are. And what you do a great job in your book of doing is explicating how the control of those areas are limited, or at least the government limits itself in controlling those territories. But also, there are no defined borders. Pakistan has never agreed to defining the borders between it and Afghanistan, agreeing to the so-called Durand Line. So in a way, what you have is a natural platform for these developments to occur and to have a transmission belt of extremists being trained, supplied in Pakistan, going across the border and then coming back.
Well, you're talking about FATA, which is the Federal Administered Tribal Areas. Now, these constitute 7 tribal agencies. Each tribal agency, together they have maybe about 3 to 4 million people in it. It's very mountainous, very rugged, very bare economy. It has never been developed. And essentially, this region, which borders Afghanistan, is ruled directly by the president. The laws are that work there are a holdover from the British period. Britain created this buffer between independent Afghanistan and British India in order to keep the Pashtun tribes in Afghanistan from marauding into British India. And this buffer was just taken up wholesale by Pakistan, and nothing has been done in the last 60 years to change the status of this buffer. Now, Democrats want political reform. They want this buffer to be brought into the Pakistan constitution so that they can benefit, so the people of FATA can benefit from the same facilities, etc., legal system, law and order, education, etc., that the rest of Pakistan does. But for the military, this has been, what I write in my book is that this has actually been a very, as you said, a very convenient platform. From the days of the training the Mujahideen, when the Soviet foreign minister would issue a demarche to Pakistan and say, you are training these militant Afghans on your soil against the Soviet government in Afghanistan, we would just reply, well, we're not, because they're not in the body of Pakistan. And by the way, if you're talking about FATA, well, FATA, of course, doesn't come into the body of Pakistan. This is governed by a separate set of laws. So it gave you a kind of escape hatch for doing whatever you did. The Kashmiri Mujahideen were trained there, the Taliban were trained there, and now, of course, even more dangerous of all. Everybody, all the extremists, Al-Qaeda is there, the Pakistani and Afghan Taliban are there, they've all said, and they basically now control Fatah. So the problem on the border is it's not so much that Pakistan has not wanted to recognize the Durand line. The issue has been that Afghanistan lays claim to a large part of Fatah and a large part of the Northwest Frontier Province. And so Afghanistan has not recognized the Durand line. This was a border that was, again, mapped out by the British. It was a convenient border which the British demarcated in their own sense of interest. And it, of course, divided the Pashtun tribes between Afghanistan on one side and Pakistan on the other.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's very important to help our audience understand. You mentioned the strategic goals of a Pakistan controlled by the military. And one that's very important that comes up again and again is that for the last three or more decades, the military has seen Afghanistan as giving it strategic depth in the threat that it perceives from India. Talk a little about that, because that's the link here, the support of the Taliban as a way to deal with India.
You see, historically, Afghanistan is a landlocked country. It has depended upon Pakistan for all its imports, its exports, its trade, and everything else. But in order, in the 50s to 60s, 70s, in order to balance off this kind of overwhelming influence that Pakistan had, it always played the India card in the sense it cozied up to India. It tried to play this balancing act between India and Pakistan so that it would not become wholly dependent on Pakistan and Pakistan would not attempt to swallow up Afghanistan. Now, it was a weak state. It was a state without an army. It was a state that depended on foreign aid, American aid, Soviet aid, you know. And so for its own national interests, it was a good way to go. But it never opposed Pakistan as such. Now, unfortunately, what has happened, after that, is that Pakistan, once the Mujahideen were in power, once the Mujahideen started their war in Afghanistan, Pakistan saw that the Indians gave a very strong backing to the Afghan Soviet regime in the 1980s. And they didn't want that to be repeated because at that time they accused the Indians of intervening in Pakistan's ethnic groups, arming and subverting them. And this is a proxy war, of course, that has gone on between India and Pakistan for the last 50 years. Their intelligence agencies operate in our territory. Our intelligence agencies operate in their territory. Kashmir, we've intervened in Kashmir. We've helped arm the Sikh rebellion in the 70s and 80s in India. They have done the same in Balochistan and amongst Sindhis. But the danger was that if the Indians were to consolidate in Afghanistan, then we would be caught in this kind of pincer movement, the Indians coming from both sides, as it were. And the army became very paranoid about this. I've always written that this threat is far more to do with the army's paranoia and a perception of what could happen rather than what is actually happening. Now, after 9/11, of course, the Indians didn't have any presence in Afghanistan throughout the 90s. The Taliban were vehemently anti-Hindu, anti-Indian. And as a consequence, we backed them because we wanted to strengthen their anti-India feelings. After 9/11, of course, the people who come into power are the Northern Alliance, who had been fighting the Taliban. And the Northern Alliance had been armed and supported by India, by Iran, by Russia, by other regional powers. And consequently, after 9/11 and the war ended, we took back the Afghan Taliban, even though we had pledged to the Americans that we would be supporting the war on terror. We took back the Afghan Taliban in the hope that even though we helped defeat them, we now needed them again because we feared that India would once again come to play a major role in Afghanistan. Now, if you ask the army today, if you ask any leading person in the foreign ministry, they will tell you India is playing a dominating role in Afghanistan. Well, I mean, I think that's nonsense. You know, the Americans and NATO and about 30 other countries who have troops in Afghanistan are playing a much more important role. They're giving more money, they're giving troops, etc., etc. India is playing a role, but it doesn't have any troops there. It has an aid program for the Afghan reconstruction. But again, this tit-for-tat war has started. Pakistan is accusing the Indians of intervening in Pakistan. And this is why the army has used the India factor as an excuse for maintaining support for the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. Now, in this equation, we now have to add the United States. And the point, we'll talk a little later about U.S. policy in the region, but I think what's very important is that these Pakistani foci that the military has really led them to interpret their relations to benefit their strategic goals and not necessarily what the U.S. Wants. So from the time that we were using Pakistan to fight the Soviets through the Mujahideen to the period after 9/11, the Pakistanis take the money but do other things with the money that support these goals that you've just described.
Well, I think that's been true all along. For example, the Pakistan Army was very closely allied to the U.S. during the Cold War. And in fact, the Americans built up the Pakistan Army in the 60s precisely as a weapon in case the Soviets, came south and decided to, occupy the Gulf region, etc. Now, even then, Pakistan used a lot of the armaments and money that the U.S. gave not to build up a force that would counter the Soviets who would be invading from the northwest, but to build up a force against India. Mm-hmm. And this has been the historical relationship. I mean, the Americans have not been ignorant of this. The Americans know perfectly, have known perfectly well. We are arming and funding the Pakistanis against the Soviet Union, but they're going to use it against India. And we did. We fought three wars against India using American weapons. And those wars, of course, led to sanctions on Pakistan for several years, in which bitterness grew in the army, and the Pakistanis kept saying to the Americans, "Well, we always told you that we would be using your weapons to fight India. We would not be using your weapons to fight the Soviets." So I think in 9/11, what happened after 9/11 was that there was this outpouring of support for Pakistan. Obviously, Pakistan was the main route by which American forces would invade Afghanistan. It was the main supply route for the American occupation forces who were in Afghanistan after the war ended. And so Pakistan was very much needed. And Pakistan, again, uses this for its own purposes. It uses, for example, since 9/11, the U.S. has given something like nearly $11 billion to Pakistan in aid. 80% of that aid has gone to the military. Mm-hmm. Now, what has the military done with that aid? Now, the U.S. demand was that you should train counterinsurgency forces in mountain warfare to fight the Taliban in the tribal areas. Rather, we have used these to buy heavy-duty weaponry for the India border, And only now has the Bush administration kind of woken up to this, and Congress has woken up to this. And Congress is now, in fact, even contemplating that no future arms sales to Pakistan, which are directed at India, should be sold by the U.S. And the U.S. is now trying to train and arm paramilitary forces for fighting the insurgency in northwest Pakistan. But the real issue here is that, in the last 7 years, again, I think, as my book says, Musharraf, when he first had his first meetings with the generals after 9/11, he agreed and he wanted to support the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. But at the same time, some generals were opposed to it. Others said, okay, that's fine. We'll use the U.S. We'll say yes now, but we'll say no later on. Mm-hmm. We'll take their money. We'll do what they want now. But later on, we will fit this new shift in strategic direction that we are being forced to do by the US, by this ultimatum that Rumsfeld and Colin Powell give to Pakistan. We'll shift this around so that it works in our interests. And in particular, the particular interest of the Pakistanis after 9/11 was to maintain the Taliban as a proxy force.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the U.S. gave an opening in the sense that its focus was on the hunt for al-Qaeda. Now, I think it's very important because there's a point in your book where you say that in the recent period there's been a greater American pressure to deal with the Taliban, and you point out that to deal with this situation, the ISI, and you should explain what that is, essentially created a non-governmental organization, a group of contractors who were on the side helping the Taliban because the military couldn't be open about doing that.
Well, Harry, first of all, I think you're absolutely right. I think the critical strategic mistake made by the Americans after the war ended was to narrowly focus all the regional allies it had to get al-Qaeda and bin Laden. You know, and they basically said to the Pakistanis, you know, the Taliban are coming back here. We're not bothered about the Taliban. You can do what you like with the Taliban. You know, and President Karzai of Afghanistan would rush to Washington, you know, every few months and tell Bush bluntly that, look, al-Qaeda is not the threat I face. Al-Qaeda is a few hundred guys. I mean, they may try and launch terrorist attacks in Europe, but they're not going to overthrow my regime. The people who are going to overthrow my regime and hurt your presence and your support are the Taliban. You have to do something about these sanctuaries. And this administration just did not listen to that. They weren't interested in that, largely because of Iraq. They were bogged down in Iraq. Now, certainly, I think to run the Taliban after 9/11 was very difficult because, first of all, the CIA had very intense cooperation with the ISI, which is the Inter-Services Intelligence. This is the overarching Pakistani military intelligence service, which runs the politics and the foreign policy, and it's extremely powerful. It is, you know, tens of thousands of agents on its payroll all around the country. They interfere with almost everything. But essentially, they had formulated the Afghan policy and the Kashmir policy since the 1980s. The ISI wanted to maintain the Taliban, but they were cooperating with the CIA on hunting down al-Qaeda, which the ISI did hunt down. And they caught a large number of al-Qaeda people, some of them very senior, such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's now on trial for organizing 9/11. But they had to create something which was completely outside the military, outside the ISI, which could not be tracked down by the CIA, which would not have a be part of any official budget, which did not employ, the CIA, for example, had lists of all the employees of ISI, and they could monitor exactly, you know, who was doing what, where, when, and how. Now, in order to avoid that kind of monitoring, the ISI created an ISI within the ISI. It was basically run like an NGO. It was run like a non-governmental agency, you know, where you come in for part-time work. Your official job is you're retired. You're an army officer who spent 20 years helping the Taliban or 10 years in fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. You speak the language. You know the people. You know the leaders. But now you're retired. You have a job as a teacher or you're a professor somewhere or you're retired in some other capacity. And you come back into the system. You work for 3 to 4 weeks, and you tell everyone at home, I'm going off on holiday to the, you know, whatever, and you come and work with the Taliban, and then you go home again. And that was how it was essentially run, so it was untraceable. And, Americans in 2003, 2004, the Americans were asking all the Pakistanis, well, how do you think, is there a rogue ISI? Is there, and this was the feeling for a long time, that somehow there were rogue officers who were more Taliban than the Taliban, who had somehow set up a clandestine organization in the ISI, while serving in the ISI, who were running the Taliban. And I maintained, I wrote very publicly at that time, that there was no rogue ISI. This decision to back the Taliban was a state policy. It was made by Musharraf himself. And it was passed down, and the ISI were the implementers of this second structure that was created in order to avoid detection by the Americans.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the relationship of this military, the ISI, to this whole nuclear proliferation question? We have the case of A.Q. Khan. In other words, was this another of the military strategic goals that had unintended consequences, or were they in charge of the operation all along? And here we're talking about the fact that Mr. Khan was selling technology and information about how to build bombs to both Iran and then later to North Korea to get missiles.
Well, you know, this is a very murky area, but it is, and publicly and privately even very little is known about it because the secrets are held by very, very few people. But most Pakistanis accept the fact that the military was deeply involved in everything that A.Q. Khan was doing. There was no way A.Q. Khan was operating on his own, that he was selling technology to Libya and Iran and all these countries without backing from the military, because he was using all the army's facilities, aircraft, offices, you know, his bodyguards were military people. He had officers working with him, etc. Now, the problem here is that, you know, that clearly, and there's been no accounting, by the way, of the money that Pakistan earned through this sale. There was the suggestion that A.Q. Khan made a lot of money. Well, he may have made a lot of money, but we're talking of hundreds of millions of dollars that were earned by selling this proliferation. And I think most Pakistanis believe that much of this money was used for this vast budget that the ISI has. Don't forget, in the 80s and 90s, when much of this proliferation took place, the ISI were running operations in Afghanistan. They were running the Taliban and having to support them and pay for them. They were running very heavily involved in running the insurgency in Kashmir. They had two full-scale insurgencies that they had to operate upon. They needed vast sums of money for this. Now, where exactly the money went, did it go directly to the military? Did it go to the ISI? I mean, I really don't know. But A.Q. Khan himself recently in the last few days has come out with several interviews saying, you know, I was not the only one responsible. The army chiefs know exactly what happened and who benefited from this. I think, you know, this is going to emerge, but it's a very sensitive issue. The Bush administration has said, when the scandal erupted in 2004, 2005, the Bush administration ultimately gave a clean pass to the army, because they knew that if we dig a little deeper and we implicate the military in this proliferation, the military is going to go haywire, and they may stop supporting us in the hunt for al-Qaeda. And they didn't want to jeopardize that for the sake of going after what really happened in this non-proliferation. I'm sure the Americans have enough files and enough evidence which probably shows that the military was involved. But it's something that they are not going to, the Bush administration was not going to rake up. Now, of course, it's very interesting, and it's a very sensitive issue in Pakistan, because if you get a Democratic administration coming in, the Democrats are very tough on, have always been very tough on proliferation, much tougher than the Republicans.
You're talking about the Americans. Americans.
I mean, if you get a Democratic president coming in November, the Democrat lobby for non-proliferation is much tougher than the Republican lobby. And there could be pressure from some of the Democrats, maybe on the new Democratic president, to really get to the bottom of this, which, of course, would put at serious risk the whole relationship between the Pakistan military and the Americans. So it remains a hot potato in the sense that it really has not been uncovered yet, and the truth has not come out, but it will. And when it does come out, I'm sure it is going to implicate a lot of people and put a lot of things at risk also.
There's another quote that I have here from that you cite in your book. I'm thinking now of what you just said about the way Pakistan has dealt with the United States. Pakistan negotiates with its friends by pointing a gun at its own head, which is what you were just describing.
I mean, unfortunately, yes. I mean, you know, sometimes when we see the kind of extreme measures that the military is prepared to take, You know, and I think I recount that in the incident, many such incidents, but in particular, the build-up against India in 2002, mm-hmm. when we sent this the military sent this message to the Indians through the Americans. And there was a danger at that time of all-out war, nuclear war, and there was a danger that the Indians were going to invade Sindh province in the south of the country and split Pakistan in two, leaving Punjab and where all the heavy concentration of the army was separately. And we sent a message saying that if an Indian armored division comes through into Sindh, we will put a nuke on that armored division in Sindh, which, of course, would kill tens of thousands of Pakistanis also, because the Indians would be inside Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of thing, I mean, has obviously been immense, you know, led to immense cause of concern.
Mm-hmm. Let me show your book, and then we'll take a break, actually. So let's talk about U.S. Policy and the Western response to events, especially in Afghanistan. The U.S., it seems in every period that we've been talking about, the 80s under Reagan, the 90s under Clinton, and then after 9/11, has really kind of acted in a way that has really cut the wrong way in terms of solving the problems that were being addressed. We supported the Mujahideen through Pakistan, which then unintentionally led to al-Qaeda. Clinton in the 90s let the Saudis and the Pakistanis take the lead with regard to the Afghan civil war. And then, as we've just talked about, the Bush administration after 9/11 was narrowly focused on al-Qaeda and really sort of missed all the big picture.
The Afghans in particular are very bitter about this because they consider the real betrayal of the U.S. took place in 1989 when the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan and the U.S. walked away as well. And that, you know, not helping rebuild the country, help form a government. And that, of course, led to the civil war that we had in the 90s in which ultimately the Taliban came up on top. After 9/11, I think the real fault, essentially there were two. The first was the sole focus on al-Qaeda at the expense of any kind of, you know, rebuilding the country, reconstruction, etc. And secondly was very quickly the decision to go into Iraq. And I describe how by March or April in 2002, you know, 12 weeks after the war was won, you know, I mean, people were still in a state of shock. The few resources that the U.S. had in Afghanistan, special forces, the satellites, the imagery, the reconnaissance, et cetera, they were all taken out. And they were sent stateside and they were set in for retraining for Iraq. And you got the second string of perhaps, you know, not such highly trained U.S. forces coming into Afghanistan. And then, as a result of this focus on Iraq, the CIA basically had a policy of maintaining law and order in the country, or so they thought, through the warlords. So there was this policy of arming and putting the warlords on the payroll, on the American payroll. And that was devastating because, you know, the warlords had been driven out by the Taliban precisely because the Afghan people were so fed up with them. Mm-hmm. The warlords throughout the 90s had devastated the country. They had pillaged and, you know, harassed and stolen people's property and everything else. And here was the Americans, the liberators of Afghanistan, the people who have overthrown the Taliban, who freed us from oppression, bringing back the warlords on their payroll, mm-hmm. you know. And that was something that the Afghans became very, very bitter about, you know. Mm-hmm. Karzai himself was not able to do anything about it because this was, you know, I mean, he was told just, you know, you just stay there as a kind of weak president. The warlords will control the countryside. And we're doing Iraq, by the way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're second or third on the list now. You're not the number one on the list. And, of course, the problem with the warlords was that they began to defy Karzai. They said, well, look, I mean, we've got CIA. Who are you? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you might be the president, but, you know, we're on the CIA payroll. I've got 3,000 militiamen. You had warlords who had 200 tanks, 300 tanks. I mean, you couldn't annoy them. So Karzai's hands were tied in that sense because, you know, there was this American backing for the warlords. And this only stopped around 2004 when they were taken off the payroll. But by then, these warlords had gone into drugs and business and trafficking. Mm-hmm. And all sorts of other. So they were, you know, remained incredibly rich, politically powerful, ruthless, you know. I mean, but they, now they were wearing suits. They weren't wearing, you know, a militia uniform. They would be wearing suits and ties. They found places in parliament. Many of them stood in the presidential election, which the UN and all tried to make sure that they didn't, but the Americans insisted that they should stand. So, you know, this warlord policy, which was actually the creation of Paul Wolfowitz, and I several times called Mr. Wolfowitz, he's the Deputy Secretary of State for Deputy Secretary of Defense. I called him Warlord Wolfowitz, you know. he was trying to, he thought this was such a profound discovery. He was trying to sell the policy in Somalia and in Sudan and in other parts, saying that we should be arming and funding independent militia warlords who would go after al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. So the other problem, of course, was that these warlords were told to hunt al-Qaeda, but half these warlords were in bed with al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. They were taking money from al-Qaeda also. So they weren't going to betray al-Qaeda. No warlord has ever delivered a senior al-Qaeda figure to the Americans. Mm-hmm.
And I want you to talk a little about this drug business because I think it becomes very important. If you don't get nation building, you don't get reconstruction, you don't get security that is required for development and reconstruction, then what you get is an economy that the locals find the drug trade as a place to go, the poor farmer to survive, the warlords to make money, and the Taliban and al-Qaeda basically can rake off money also.
You know, right after the war, myself and a bunch of scholars who were working on Afghanistan in America, we literally begged the State Department and the Agency for International Development, USAID, to invest in agriculture. You know, 80% of Afghanistan, Afghans were living on agriculture. Within the next few months, 2.5 million refugees came back home from Pakistan and Iran. What were these people supposed to do? There were no jobs. The land was devastated. And they all went back to their villages and their farms. And there was no investment in agriculture. Mm-hmm. And what you needed, and it was a minimal investment. You know, you needed new crops. You needed fertilizer. You needed some farm-to-market roads. You needed better water distribution, etc. And you know, agriculture was such a thing that we said, you know, you can have a turnaround in one or two harvests, in one or two growing cycles. You can turn the whole economy around. You know, perhaps you can get them to grow crops which you would buy up yourself and pay more money than the crop was worth, simply to get the farmers on their feet again, you know. But there was no investment in agriculture, and the result was that everybody went back to growing something that didn't need any infrastructure. To grow poppy, you don't need fertilizer, you don't need water, you don't need infrastructure. It grows anywhere on almost anything. And that's what the poor farmers did. And eventually, initially, it became, of course, a major source of livelihood for millions of farmers across the country, but particularly in the south of the country. And very quickly, the Taliban were back. In 2003, the Taliban came back. They first started taxing the farmers. After that, they started taxing the local traffickers who were picking up the opium at the farm gate and then transporting it to a big trafficker. Then they started taxing the big traffickers, you know. So there was this progression, and today, I mean, I have no doubt that Al Qaeda and the Taliban are heavily involved in not just making money, which is a pittance at the bottom end of the ladder, which is where the farmers are, but they're making money at the top end of the ladder, which is where the distribution is in Europe and you know, where the final destination is, where of course that opium you know, doubles and triples and quadruples in the price, and you rake in far bigger profit. And if you look at the money today that these groups have, the Pakistani Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, I mean, They have enormous sums of money with which they're able to keep thousands of militiamen in the field. They're paying their soldiers now. You know, in the 90s, the Taliban never paid their soldiers. It was a holy war. I mean, you know, now they're paying up to $100 to $150 a month to the soldiers, which is about twice as much as what an Afghan soldier in the regular army gets. So, you know, they're paying the families of the suicide bombers. So if your son goes to commit suicide and kills a few Americans, depending on how successful he was, the father and the mother and the parents get a huge lump sum of money to compensate for the son's death. Mm-hmm. So now we are seeing an insurgency and a movement that is flush with cash. A lot of it is coming from the drug trade.
Mm-hmm. And now Afghanistan produces what percent of the world?
Well, Afghanistan today produces 93% of the world's heroin. And unfortunately, you know, the international community has had no real strategy. Mm-hmm. There was the argument made back in 2003 when the opium escalation had started that at least the American forces and subsequently NATO. Okay, we're not asking for American soldiers to go into the fields and hack down the poppy crop, you know, and antagonize the farmers. But at least what American forces could have done was interdiction, stopping the convoys, picking up the really big traffickers, who everybody knew who they were, you know, and everybody still knows who they are. The Americans had the helicopters, they had the special forces, they had the troops. The Afghan government didn't have any of these resources. Mm-hmm. You could have stopped these convoys, you could have picked up a lot of people brought them to justice either in Afghanistan or in America or anywhere else. And this was just not done because Rumsfeld refused to involve the U.S. military in any form of counter-narcotics. Now, and the State Department fought a running battle with Rumsfeld on that issue, but got nowhere because, you know, Rumsfeld was controlling the military.
You know, as I listen to you and as I read your works, and especially this new book, it's like there's a big picture here, and all of the actors, for their own narrow vested interests, refuse to see the big picture. And their narrow focus, which they think are solving a problem. So Rumsfeld, I guess, thinks he's solving the problem of terrorism. But by not seeing this big picture, not understanding what's happening on the ground, sort of does all the wrong things, and even in a way beyond we here in the United States understand, because it's what's happening on the ground here. So essentially, you create a system that produces more and more terrorism by not dealing with the politics and the economy and the society in a comprehensive way.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at all the major players, whether it's Musharraf or Bush or Karzai or anyone, they were dealing with their own local problem rather than looking at the big picture. But I think most at fault were the Americans, because the Americans had an obligation to look at the big picture. They were the leading player in Afghanistan. Now, I think partly why they just utterly failed was the focus on Iraq. And even in Iraq, you can argue that they didn't look at the big picture. Yeah. You know, the neighborhood, the other Arab states, Iran, how would the Iranians react to an invasion of Iran? You know, they just looked at this narrow that we're going to take Baghdad, topple Saddam, etc. But I think, you know, precisely this point is what this what the next U.S. president has to do. Mm-hmm. There is a strategic. You have to look at the region in a strategic way. Now, and especially so now. Now, I mean, for example, if you want to deal with Afghanistan, you want to settle Afghanistan, you have to deal with the sanctuaries in Pakistan. If you want to deal with Pakistan, you have to get the Indians on board to give the Pakistan army some kind of feeling of security. You have to help resolve the Kashmir dispute. The same on the other side goes for Iran. If you want to settle Afghanistan, you have to talk to the Iranians and you have to give them some reassurances. Now, what I'm trying to say is that there is a strategic picture here, that this president utterly failed to President Bush. President Bush.
President Musharraf, actually, in a smaller way.
Absolutely. And the next American president will have to look at the strategic picture and be able to conduct, you know, you need a dozen hands. You have to conduct multiple diplomacy at a dozen different levels with half a dozen countries all at the same time to resolve one problem. You know, there's no, you know, and then within that, you have to have obviously country-specific policies. You have to deal with the Pakistan government, you have to deal with the Afghan reconstruction, whatever. But you, in order to try and settle this, I mean, you have to have a better strategic picture than what the Bush administration had.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you fault the United States beyond this in terms of implementation, but because you say, you know, we just don't have the skills and we're not willing to devote the resources and we don't have the institutions in our government to make a lot of this happen, even if we got a new president who had a strategic vision.
Well, I make a lot of that in my book. And what I say is that basically after the end of the Cold War, during the Cold War, you had the tools of nation building, if you like. You know, you rebuilt Europe after the Second World War with the Marshall Plan. You had people who were knowledgeable about the world, about economics, about et cetera, et cetera. You had, you know, agencies like the US AID, which when I was young and AID was working in Pakistan, they had agronomists and water engineers and bridge builders and road engineers. And you wouldn't find any technical person in AID today. You'd find a bunch of bureaucrats who signed checks to contractors. You know, now you had the U.S. Information Service, which was incredibly good at putting out the U.S. message in all these countries, but and also seeing the press and influencing the local press. You did away with all that, and a lot of this was done away with at the end of the Cold War by the Clinton administration. It wasn't deliberately done; it was just run down. You know, and Bush came in, in fact, and merged AID with the State Department. He merged the information services again with the State Department. And these agencies, you know, in Treasury, you used to have a capacity to actually help other countries with their currency problems and with their inflation and all this. You know, you've lost that ability. You don't have anyone in Treasury now who can go out to Kabul and help deal with the currency problems there. You know, and so unfortunately what has happened is that these institutions that were there have been utterly run down. So the U.S. government does not have the capacity now. I think what we've seen in the last 2 years of the Bush administration, they are aware of this. And there have been numerous reports by American institutions which have pointed this out. And they are trying to rebuild some capacity in the State Department. But and they now have a special section in the State Department, which is called something. It's not called nation building, but it's related to that. But I mean, clearly, this is the war. You know, the wars of the future are not going to be fought just by special forces and high tech gadgetry and satellites and drones and all the rest of it. They're going to be fought by what comes after the war. What kind of political deal can you put together after the war to settle you know, political differences and issues in countries? And of course, we've seen the tragedy of Afghanistan and Iraq. The same mistakes were made in both countries. Not enough troops on the ground. Overdependence on technology and gadgetry. You know. Secondly, no plan to rebuild the country. Actually, in Iraq, the State Department had learned, and they did have a plan, but the plan was scotched by Rumsfeld. Mm-hmm. It was taken away by Rumsfeld. The Pentagon is not supposed to do nation building. So for the, you know, the Pentagon, it may win the war, but then it has to hand over the political and the economic side to the State Department and to other departments of the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. So it's been very tragic that, you know, exactly I've watched this and really wept, because the same mistakes that you've done in Iraq, we were seeing in 2002, 2003 in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. you know, and just saying, well, I hope the Americans don't repeat this anywhere else, mm-hmm. because this has been a big blunder. And there you are for sure. You know, 18 months later, you're repeating exactly the same mistakes in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you really do fault the Europeans also, because when they came in the secondary role, they were reluctant players, focused again on their own area, their own NGO, concerned about the voter back at home, not wanting to lose a life on the military side. Talk a little about that, because they, as they say in the CIA, the Europeans didn't really want to walk the talk, basically.
Yeah. I you know, what I read about the Europeans is two things. I mean, I think the Europeans were felt very betrayed by the Americans after 2001, when they offered all their support and NATO's support, and basically the Bush administration rejects them. And that, of course, piques the Europeans, angers them, upsets them, and they're made into kind of second-class donors. Oh, we'll do the fighting, you can do the rebuilding, or you can do education and health in Afghanistan, you know. And then, of course, when the U.S. comes to Europe genuinely to seek their support for the war in Iraq, the Europeans said, well, you rejected us there, why should we support you here? Finally, the Europeans come on board, NATO comes on board in 2005, in 2005, because the Americans were so bogged down in Iraq and the insurgency had started in Iraq and America could not spare the troops. So they go to NATO again and say, please, you know, come and help us out. But by then, I think the anti-Bush feeling in Europe because of the war in Iraq was running so high that it was very difficult for these governments to actually commit troops to the battlefront. Because I really fault the Europeans at not educating their publics. The governments did not educate their publics, one, on the dangers of Al-Qaeda and the whole terrorism thing. And secondly, they didn't educate their publics about the difference between the war in Afghanistan, which was a UN-mandated war. It was a war that was supported by the whole world, the international community, et cetera, et cetera. And the war in Iraq, which was a war of choice by the Americans alone. You know, and there was a difference between the two. And you should not have treated Iraq and Afghanistan as one war. But many Europeans did. They said, oh, troops in Iraq, troops in Afghanistan. It's the same thing. It's a Bush's war. We're not going to fight this war. So so I really fault the European governments. And then after that, of course, once they committed the troops they imposed so many restrictions on what their troops could do. Every country had a long list of caveats. In other words, restrictions that they couldn't fight. They couldn't fight at night. They couldn't carry Afghans in their helicopters. They wouldn't do this. They wouldn't do that. It was almost ridiculous because, you know, and the Afghans were laughing. I mean, the Afghans said, you know, this is a Western army, you know, this is the feared, you know, NATO alliance that was going to defeat the Soviet Union, and they won't fight at night. And for example, the Germans stipulated that an ambulance had to follow, a whole ambulance had to follow every patrol, which meant that the patrol could only go on the dirt roads. The patrols could never go in the mountains because and no ambulance could follow in the mountains. So, I mean, you know, there were all these kind of absurd things, and I think that really upset the Afghans, it upset the Americans, and it sent a message, a very strong message to the Taliban and to Pakistan, that these Western countries are basically non-serious about winning the war in Afghanistan. So pile on the pressure, you know, let's target these vulnerable NATO countries. And the Taliban had a brilliant strategy of trying to create crises with the government back home. So, for example, they kidnap an Italian journalist, threaten to kill him. There's a crisis back home. The government in Italy fell. For 10 days, there was no government in Italy because the government was hanging by a two-vote majority in parliament. And this crisis, you know, geared up the left and all the rest of it. And the government fell. Now, I mean, that was just an enormous kind of propaganda victory for the Taliban. And that's what they're trying to do repeatedly. They would love to see in the next 6 months, as a result of the present summer offensive in 2008, that, you know, one or two countries actually leave Afghanistan.
One has to say that this book that you've written and we've been talking about makes a very important contribution to educating the American public about this big picture that the next American president is going to have to address.
I hope so, but I hope it also educates the Pakistani public, you know, about the role of the military and about how civil society needs to assert itself. I hope it educates the Afghans too. I mean, everyone in the region as to what really happened. And how their expectations were dashed, why their expectations were dashed, And what can be done essentially to try and get, you know, all these countries back on track again.
On that note, Ahmed, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for coming back to Berkeley.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.